This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Here we are with another edition of Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock, joined as always by Brandon Thurston. Welcome to the show. Today's show is presented by documents and opinions, 44 pages of them.
Today's show is an unsponsored presentation of Adobe PDF Reader.
That is correct. That is what we are going to be diving heavily into with a 44-page court ruling that came down. We are going to make sense out of all of this and convey it to you in English. Off the top, though, I wanted to just make two mentions. The first being the unfortunate passing this past weekend of writer Jamie Hemmings, who had done a lot of work at Slam Wrestling over the past two decades. And I mean, just personally, and I'm sure Brandon as well, in covering the Ring Boy lawsuit and scandal that goes back years and years. She had done some really extensive pieces concerning Barry Orton and a multiple part series that she wrote about him in speaking with him, and was also in close contact with Tom Cole up until his passing, which we'll get into in just a second. But she wrote some really important stories out there, and she was only 43 years of age passing away this weekend. So I did want to make mention of that. The other being Tom Cole. Today, it was 4 years ago today that Tom Cole took his life. So want to mention that off the top. He left behind a wife and three daughters. Obviously, his name is frequently brought up in the news. But, you know, this was someone that, you know, had family that was left behind. And it's already been 4 years since he died as well. So I want to make those mentions off the top before we get into today's legal filings.
And her work was primarily for Slam Wrestling, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, she did quite a lot of work with various interviews and features that she wrote, various book reviews as well. But I would certainly, if you're just singling out some of her work, like the multiple part series she did with Barry Orton, and then writing about Tom Cole after he had died as well. Like, she had had a lot of private conversations with Tom Cole, and towards the, like, last year of his life that she was in contact with him, which not too many people were in that period of time. Like, we had not really heard from Tom Cole in those previous years before the news of his passing in February of 2021. But Brandon, a very mysterious drop occurred on Friday night that went undetected, and then Monday discovering these 44 pages where a lot of this was veiled in secrecy regarding an argument that went down last September and decided upon on Friday. And we were introduced to new terms, including sealed appellant number one, number two, and number three, which sounds like a mid-80s heel act. And we do have identities that pretty much check out as to who sealed appellant number one, two, and three are, which we will get into the descriptions here. But in essence, this is describing Vince McMahon and his work alongside sealed appellant two and three, which, I mean, for anyone that is reading through this, it very much lines up with Jerry McDivitt, his former legal counsel, and Jerry McDivitt's firm, K&L Gates, which were, you know, for a long time representing WWE matters, going all the way back to Jim Neidhart in 1990. So a long time that Jeremy
was it 90? I thought it was 87 that he started working for them.
87 is accurate. Yes, okay. You're right. So yeah, we're going back nearly four decades of work with the McMahons and by extension WWF/WWE. So the first bit of contention here, Brandon, the opening paragraph in this this 44-page opinion was that sealed appellant one, which for the purposes of this description, we're just going to refer to them as the names that we believe them to be, that McMahon, the former CEO of a publicly traded company and the subject of an ongoing jury investigation. Now, what is so difficult about this particular paragraph that there is dispute among?
Ongoing grand jury investigation. So there's an article in the New York Post this morning that they branded as an exclusive. The headline is Feds Drop Criminal Probe into Whether WWE Boss Vince McMahon Covered Up Sexual Misconduct Allegations. And they based this largely on a quote from one of Vince McMahon's attorneys, which is the same quote that we had last night. So I'm not sure this is really an exclusive, but I'm sure Vince McMahon is happy with this headline, where Vince McMahon's attorney, Robert W. Allen, who appears to be one of the attorneys who are helping Vince McMahon, who are representing Vince McMahon in this criminal matter with the Southern District of New York. And his statement is, quote, "This is simply the result of an appeal of a procedural matter that was argued 5 months ago. We have been in consistent communication with the government since that time and with no ambiguity that the invest and we can say with and understand with no ambiguity that the investigation has definitively concluded and will not result in charges." So the Vince McMahon side is very confident that this investigation is all over with. It's all said and done. Whatever is happening here with the Southern District of New York, which we're getting the first insight into with this 44-page appellate court filing. I mean, that contrasts, and you might say contradicts, what is in the first sentence after the title page here of this filing, which was submitted on Friday, not weeks ago or months ago, but this past Friday.
This was not written in September when this was argued. Like this was issued on Friday. So if we're arguing like has the tense since changed? I mean, this is dated February 7th, just for, so at the very least, there's some ambiguity here.
Yes. And not according to Vince's lawyers, of course, but this says the subject, he's referring to Vince, the subject of an ongoing grand jury investigation, which is the reporting up to this point has been that there's a grand jury convened to consider whether Vince McMahon violated any criminal laws here. This is the first insight we're really getting in any significant way into what's happening with the Southern District of New York. We've had it reported for over a year that Vince McMahon has been under investigation for possible criminal charges. He's not been charged with anything, to be clear, but has been under investigation for quite some time from the Southern District of New York. We know that the civil case that was filed by Janelle Grant, that was put on hold back in June. And we got some filings that indicated that there are U.S. attorneys, that there are prosecutors from the Southern District of New York, including one, Sarah Mortazavi, what was someone who submitted a filing that coinciding with the timing of the Grant case being put on hold. So we have her, a federal prosecutor who's mentioned here in this case. So what happened here, to get into the procedural legal stuff, is that the Southern District of New York subpoenaed Vince McMahon and his former lawyer, who is consistent with being Jerry McDivitt. They subpoenaed them for documents, including their communications records. They tried to invoke attorney-client privilege, of course, which is a privilege that an attorney and a client can invoke to secure the confidentiality of their communications. The federal court, the lower court, ruled that no, there appears to be probable cause that this was involved in some sort of fraud, and that is related to the SEC violations and so forth. So they said, no, you don't have attorney-client privilege because of the nature of what we suspect is happening here. The judge ruled that way. They appealed. So sealed appellant one, Vince McMahon, sealed appellant two, who we believe is pretty likely to be Jerry McDivitt, and sealed appellant three, which we believe is likely to be K&L Gates, the law firm at which Jerry McDivitt is a partner. They appealed. Those parties appealed, and this was brought into the higher court, the appeals court, the Second Circuit, and the judges here did not make a decision on whether or not they violated the law or whether they committed any crimes. That's not what they were deciding. They were deciding whether or not it was valid for them to raise attorney-client privilege, and they decided no. You do need to allow the grand jury to see your communications records, perhaps among other documents.
Yeah. So when you cite attorney-client privilege, the government can overrule that with something called the crime fraud exception, which permits the government to obtain access to what would be otherwise privileged communications that could further an ongoing crime or fraud. Right. As
just
well.
To speak in generalities, I'm not saying that's what happened here, but if a lawyer and a client were orchestrating some sort of cover up that included fraud, you don't get to invoke attorney-client privilege in that case. The prosecutors and the law can force you to disclose this information.
Yeah, it said here in the ruling that despite arguments, the opinion reads that they see no abuse of discretion in the district court's application of the crime fraud exception, meaning they can that they are essentially backing the lower court's initial decision. So then it goes into some specifics here, mainly involving victim number one and victim number two. Victim number one is the unknown former female that had the $7.5 million settlement, which was signed in early 2019. Victim number two, while referred to as that in this, I mean, this is Janelle Grand. And of course, that's a very public case and all of that lines up. But we do get some details in here. Some of what was known, others, we get a bit more detail into the negotiations for these settlements. And that the person believed to be Jerry McDivitt helped negotiate two NDAs between 2018 and 2022, to which the company, that being WWE, was a party, but were not disclosed to the company's in-house legal department or its auditors. Both agreements were with former female company employees who alleged sexual misconduct. Victim number one reached out to Vince McMahon in 2018, alleging that she was sexually harassed and assaulted working there in 2004 and 5, and that a demand letter was sent to McDivitt, alleging that McMahon had, quote, attempted to kiss her, exposed himself to her, and obtained non-consensual oral sex from her, all while being employed by the company, and that her career ended because she refused to engage in consensual sex with McMahon, seeking $18 million for a resolution, although was not threatening a lawsuit in the demand letter, but that was essentially the figure that was that she was seeking to basically keep this private. They did come to an agreement for $7.5 million to be paid out over 5 years in exchange for confidentiality and a release of any claims she or her husband had or might have had against McMahon. This was finalized in February of 2019, which is an interesting date that will tie into all of this. It stated that though certain provisions were added or altered from the original draft, including a provision that contemplated victim number one's one day writing a book about her life story, possibly after sealed appellant one's death, that being McMahon's death, the fundamental terms of $7.5 million for confidentiality and a release remained consistent.
Yeah. So one thing I was thinking while reading this is that this story that we've been covering, I guess, since early 2024, really since mid 2022, if this person ends up writing a book someday after Vince McMahon's death, I mean, there's going to be like tells me there's sort of just a slow trickle. If you're sick of us covering this story, I'm sorry. This is a story that I think is going to be around for a very long time as details slowly come out over the years. But that's interesting. It's not clear. It's not explicitly clear that this provision was finalized, was added into the finalized contract, because it says, again, including a provision that contemplated victim one's one day writing a book about her life story, possibly after sealed appellant's death. The bit before that is though certain provisions were added or altered. So it sounds like it was probably, I read that it as they're probably saying that it was added into the final draft of this contract that was signed, but it's not super clear. In any case, that's interesting to think that there might be a book that gets in some detail about what exactly happened here, maybe after Vince McMahon has passed away. if he doesn't live forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like we have seen now several, like Janelle Grant, for all that we have seen outlined in the complaint, that was a $3 million settlement over several years. This one was $7.5 million. Like this was, I think it's very significant that they felt the need to ultimately reach this NDA at that time in 2019. But it goes on to state that sealed appellants one and two. So again, McMahon and allegedly McDivitt also did not disclose victim one's initial $18 million demand or the settlement of $7.5 million to the company or its auditors, even though victim one's claims, which as noted above, referenced possible claims against the company and remained unresolved on December 31st, 2018, the end of the company's fiscal year. McDivitt also failed to mention the claims in sealed appellant three, that being K&L Gates' January 31st, 2019 audit response letter, which purportedly disclosed all pending or threatened litigation through January 25th, 2019, and that McMahon did not mention the claims or settlement agreement in his February 7th, 2019 management representation letter or his fraud inquiry interview with auditors on the same day. A lot of language in there, but let us look at this. This, Brandon, feels to me as one as though this was a major error that they were likely aware of, that this is the template for what happens 3 years later with Janelle Grant, where they have to get this NDA signed before that year's auditors meeting. And the fact is, this was not disclosed in 2019 as it should have been, because this was pending litigation that they were still in the midst of negotiating this settlement with victim number one, and is being brought up here as like this mirrors exactly the predicament that they were in January 2022 when McMahon tells Janelle Grant that you have the company over a barrel.
Yeah. When you say error, so this is something that they should have disclosed to the board and to the board's audit committee, but did not disclose in 2018 going into 2019. And we have that voice memo transcript that was put into General Grant's updated complaint recently, where he's talking about, you know, the issues that he's facing, and it involves Jerry McDivitt having to make disclosures to the audit committee a few years later. It's interesting that they were willing to let this go unreported and let sort of this deadline pass in 2019, but were less willing, or I don't know if, you know, McDivitt was less willing to do it again the following year. Maybe those it was opening themselves up to some liability. It's difficult to say. But this gets into why this is an issue for the company and why they had to correct their financial statements after the fact, even though, you know, supposedly these payments came out of Vince McMahon's personal account. The fact is, it doesn't really matter. We might get into these details as well. I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but the company, as you know, people have often asked, well, why is WWE wrapped up in all this? These are personal payments that Vince McMahon personally made out of his personal accounts. Who cares? Why is WWE involved in this? WWE extracted a number of protections as a result of these NDAs, including these women signed contracts that not only included non-disclosure that perhaps would have protected WWE from bad press, but also they signed releases of liability to not sue WWE, not just Vince McMahon personally, but also the company. And there were signature blocks on both of these NDAs that Vince McMahon signed on both behalf of himself personally and on behalf of the company. And he's the CEO and chairman of the board and controlling shareholder, so presumably he has the power to do that. But whether the money, whether the payments came out of his personal account, whether they came out of WWE's accounts, whether they came out of my personal account, it really doesn't matter, because WWE extracted some protections or benefits as a result of these contracts being executed, despite the fact that they weren't aware of these contracts until some time later.
And it also adds that the agreement, again, this is with victim number one in 2019, was not provided or disclosed to WWE's legal department. Instead, it was stored in the files of what is believed to be K&L Gates. So you at least have the outline here that this was done to minimize the knowledge of this agreement in 2019 and at least avoid going through the channels at WWE. Now, again, I don't want you to get too speculative here, but given that we know Vince McMahon had an overarching power of as the controlling shareholder at this time, if he had opted to disclose this to the legal department, to go above board for all of this. He signs an NDA, he reports it to the legal department, it's disclosed across the board of directors. This is an agreement I have made, I am using company funds for it, or my personal funds, however. Is this ultimately the fact that they do not want, Vince McMahon does not want this publicized, that an NDA even is in existence? Like, would he be facing basically any penalties if he just disclosed all of this to the board? Like, this is a case of just not allowing anyone to, even if there was a, this was filed as just personal agreement contract and make it as benign as possible in description.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. The short answer is I don't know. We'd have to ask a securities lawyer who has expertise in this. We do, you know, come to think of it, we do have, maybe there has to be some sort of disclosure in an SEC filing somewhere. We know that there are, you know, that there's disclosures in SEC filings that, you know, are related not just to NDAs, but, you know, the Trump payments for the two donations that were given to the Trump Foundation that seem to be related to compensation for Trump's two appearances in 2007 and 2009 in WWE. There's another disclosure about money that Vince is personally making that we don't know what exactly that's related to, but it doesn't seem to be related to NDAs. So maybe there would have to be some disclosure, some vague allusion to it in SEC filings. I suppose, though, if more people in the company knew about it, there's a greater chance of this getting leaked out.
There's that risk. And I think that that is the big difference between the 2019 settlement with victim number one and then with Janelle Grant, that based on the complaint was this was precipitated by Linda McMahon gaining knowledge of this and keeping this under wraps, in essence. But if we are to look at, like, it is not illegal to sign an NDA with somebody, the details of which would likely be sealed. And I mean, even if details got out, like, what would be the pressure points that would affect a Vince McMahon in 2019, where, like, ultimately it would be like, if you can withstand any of this leaking out, like, this could have been done, I think, but with the risk that this would have been, you know, Linda McMahon gaining knowledge of this. And obviously he felt a risk of disclosing this in any possible, you know, sense by avoiding the legal department and going through those channels.
Yeah. What's interesting about what's not in this filing is that we know that there, you know, Wall Street Journal reported that there's this NDA with victim number one. There's this other NDA with Janelle Grant. There are two other earlier NDAs that were reported as part of the Wall Street Journal's reporting, and the amounts of those NDAs are included in the totals that are corroborated in SEC filings. So you know, clearly there were at least those two other NDAs, and we don't have that mentioned here. So it hints, right? It suggests that what's being scrutinized here by the Southern District of New York are only these two most recent NDAs, not the two earlier NDAs, which are, I believe, with two different WWE employees. Someone was referred to in the Wall Street Journal as a manager, not a wrestling manager, but a corporate employee manager, and also another employee. And then there's a third person who is involved in an NDA that also included John Laurinaitis. In any case, maybe those are just so far in the past that there are statutes of limitations that prevent prosecution of those issues. But that's interesting that only these two more recent NDAs are discussed here. And in addition to that, I should say too, what's also not discussed here, this is, if you're making an argument for Vince McMahon that this is only accounting issues, only financial issues are involved here. I mean, this 44-page opinion, which concerns attorney-client privilege, only concerns the issues around the disclosures of the NDA payments. It doesn't involve, you know, we're not talking about here in this filing about, you know, whether Vince McMahon sexually assaulted someone or whether he was sex trafficking Janelle Grant. We don't get that here. However, I don't know that documents that including communications between McDivitt and McMahon are necessarily something that's going to be pertinent to the sexual assault allegations. In any case, what I'm saying here is this document does support, if you believe Vince McMahon, that this is only about financial issues and disclosure issues and not about sexual assault allegations or sex trafficking allegations. And that is, this document is consistent with that. However, there are other possibilities, plausible answers about, you know, plausible explanations.
Then we go into the section on Janelle Grant. And again, the audit response letter from K&L Gates is due January 31st, 2022. And thus, that urgency to get Janelle Grant to sign the NDA, which we have now seen the text of the voicemail in the amended complaint. And she signs the NDA on January 28th, 3 days before this this audit response letter is due. During this period, McMahon stepped down as CEO and chairman. This is in 2022, just to keep everyone's timeline straight. Though he denied the allegations, he also cautioned one board member that digging into allegations about victim number one and other women risked opening, quote, Pandora's box and causing damage to them and to the company for sure.
Yes. So another instance that supports the notion that this was these NDAs were meant not only to protect Vince personally, but the company, which kind of goes with things that Vince McMahon has said over the years, that Vince and the company are one and the same.
The grand jury subpoenas were issued to McDivitt and K&L Gates on September 13th, 2023, and then they responded with documents on December the 12th, but withheld 208 documents asserting attorney-client privilege. So then fast forward to January 13th of last year, and the government filed a motion to compel production of the documents that were being withheld by McDivitt and K&L Gates, and that we have the basically they were opposing this motion. However, the company, WWE, waived any privilege it may have had over the documents. So you had McMahon, K&L Gates, and McDivitt trying to withhold documents citing the attorney-client privilege. WWE was not dying on this hill and was stating like they were not going to be contesting this if the government was compelling these documents to be handed over.
Right. And I don't think we have reason to believe that WWE itself is a subject to this grand jury investigation. We do have reason to believe that Vince McMahon at least was, if not still is. But it's another just, you know, peek into what has been this very secretive by its nature, Southern District of New York federal investigation that WWE has been, you know, cooperating with or at least interacting with. And as you said, they waived the notion that they had privilege to these what seemed to be largely communication records between Vince and Sealed Appellant 2.
Yeah, and just one more thing to the date. It was stated here. On January 13th, the government filed a motion to compel. We don't know when the opposition to this motion was filed, but at least as of that date, McMahon is still with the company. It's not until January 26th right. that he resigns. So true. if those oppositions were filed immediately after the government had filed this motion, this would present McMahon and WWE in contrasting positions on this, even though at that time McMahon was still in the company, and this is before the Janelle Grant complaint has been filed.
Right.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan, additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Plus, two editions of Rewind Away. We will revisit Bret Hart's heel run in the WWF NXT TakeOver New Orleans from 2018. Plus, we have coverage of AEW Grand Slam Australia, New Beginning in Osaka, an Ask Away, Ask Us Anything mailbag show, and of course, Captain America 4 and Collision Course every single Saturday night. All that and more at postwrestlingcafe.com. In May of 2024, McMahon was no longer asserting privilege to 38 of those documents, and that the district court held that McDivitt's failure to mention the victim's claims as contingencies in K&L Gates audit response letter and to McMahon's failure to disclose the claims or settlements in his management representation letters or fraud inquiry interviews with the auditor amounted to false or misleading statements to WWE's auditors in violation. Finally, the district court properly held that there was probable cause to believe that McMahon intentionally used McDivitt's legal services to circumvent the legal contract's control. As discussed above, McMahon was clearly aware of the control. After all, he himself shared it with the WWE's auditors. On top of that, as CEO, he was routinely required to certify his awareness of WWE's internal accounting controls in quarterly filings. Second, McMahon apparently took pains to ensure the agreements were not provided to WWE's legal department. As an initial matter, he relied on external counsel to negotiate the agreements without involving or even alerting WWE's own internal lawyers. Even though the agreements were made on behalf of WWE, neither McMahon nor McDivitt provided them to the company for review or record keeping. Instead, both agreements were kept in the files of K&L Gates, and that they relied almost exclusively on text messages rather than Vince McMahon's company email. The documents provided to us include communications revealing that McDivitt specifically instructed McMahon to transmit the executed agreement via text instead of email for the express purpose of avoiding the WWE gaining knowledge of it. Draft legal agreements for both victims were apparently exchanged this way as well.
Yes. So you don't want to do, if you're going to do things that might be inappropriate, you should probably not do that on your work email and maybe through personal text here. It's interesting, this footnote 18 that says, as the government notes, knowledge within WWE appears to have been strictly confined to two employees who had some limited knowledge of certain facts surrounding the agreements, but were not made aware that WWE was a party to them. Neither of these employees was a member of legal or accounting departments. This is referring to the Grant NDA, I believe. But it tells you there are two employees that appear to be aware of having limited knowledge. We can, I don't think we need to speculate about who that might be, other than somebody not in the legal or accounting department. And that is mentioned because that would be pertinent to disclosing these payments in the right way.
So by the end of this, I'll ask you, how does this position WWE in relation to this case? Like, I think this is overall a very strong opinion of WWE at the very least being circumvented here and having a very plausible denial regarding its overall mm-hmm. knowledge of any of this going on, save for that fact about two employees that would have at least some limited knowledge of what was going on. But as a whole, Vince McMahon was not conducting his proper duties when it came to being the CEO, disclosing this. And probably the counter argument would be to that, well, Vince McMahon is the controlling shareholder. He has this power. That would probably be being the devil's advocate here on McMahon's side. But I think this very strongly paints, the concealing of information and being able to avoid any kind of transparency within the company. And I think it's very interesting to see how the playbook was run in 2019 and missing that date, where if we're to go based on the 2022 example with General Grant, was they should have had to disclose that they were in these talks with victim number one, because it was not, an NDA had not been signed as of January 31st.
Yeah. And the voicemail memo that Grant provided in a transcript tells you that maybe Jerry McDivitt was pushing back on, if you're going to do this, we have to get it done really fast. We have to get it done before this deadline in January 2022. It is something that clearly there was effort to conceal. And we know that last month, if there's any consequence to this, that Vince McMahon was ordered to repay WWE $1.3 million, as well as he was served a penalty of $400,000. Probably pretty affordable for him, but he was penalized with something. And I gather that the reimbursement to WWE was basically related to increases. Well, it was related to compensation that he got that probably was greater than it would have been had this had this information not been public as it should have been. So the stock price was probably protected from being hurt, and it increased WWE's profitability. Probably even less. We've put aside the bad public relations story. WWE was, didn't have to recognize these several million dollars in expenses, and thus they were more profitable, which makes your stock price better than it would be otherwise. And they have the top executives have incentives, performance based incentives that include, if you hit certain marks, probably including profitability, you get compensated a little bit better. And not to mention Vince at the time and still today owned a lot of WWE stock. And or TKO stock today, he still has some 8 million shares.
We also got an email. Do you want to go through that that message we got from one of our listeners this yes. past week? If we
should I read it all? This is from Andy H, who asked us the question. On a podcast a few days ago, Brian Alvarez and Lance Storm were discussing the Janelle Grant case, and Brian shared a very interesting thought. It wasn't clear if this was an original thought or something he was repeating. Looking at the transcript that is of the voice memo, of the quote-unquote double-fucked voicemail, why was it excluded from the original complaint? And given that it was originally left out, why was it added to the amended one? Brian's thought was that the original complaint was trying to paint a compelling conspiracy of Vince, John Laurinaitis, and WWE as co-defendants, and make the case that WWE as a company was aware of and complicit in the abuse, the voicemail transcript, as well as the note about it giving her a fake email address.
IT, and, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. About IT giving her a fake email address with a man's name, which I believe is Thomas. Grant. They were giving her a display name that was not her real first name, was left out of it because it shows Vince was trying to hide their arrangement from others in the company. The new filing, on the other hand, is much more focused on persuading the judge to throw out the NDA. From that angle, including the voicemail transcript, supports the argument that the NDA was signed under duress and should be invalidated. But in revealing that voicemail, Ann Cal seems to undercut her own case against WWE. How could they have been complicit in abuse when Vince was working so hard to keep the company's audit committee from even knowing about their NDA? I think that's the gist of it. I think there's two issues here, right, that we need to separate, which is it's plausible that WWE was enabling McMahon's abuse and had knowledge of this relationship between Grant and McMahon. Grant's side would say, look at all these executives who allowed Grant to have this office that was adjoining to John Laurinaitis' office. Regardless of whether or not they knew about the NDA, you could still allege that they were negligent in that case. And wanting to undo the NDA, undo the arbitration clause specifically, is a separate issue, which we can get to, but your thoughts.
Yeah, I have a couple here. Number one, I think you have to look at the fact that when you are outlining a complaint, there is going to be your strategic element as well. Like, if the goal is to get this to court, I mean, there is also a reason that, I couldn't tell you what the reason was, but that the fact the corporate officers were anonymized in the first complaint. Now, a year later, they disclosed who the corporate employees were, as well as they confirmed to us last year. So there's that aspect of things. But yes, to Brandon's point, I think that you can certainly separate the fact of what was Vince McMahon's fiduciary duty as a CEO of disclosing these payments and subverting it from the proper channels within the company versus having a circle of people that he was more open about this too. We don't have any evidence that any of these members of the production crew that is as referred to in Vince's text, the text messages are very real that we know of. And we know of, Michael Hayes being sent something by Janelle Grant. Was that solicited by Michael Hayes? Was that sent to him unsolicited? We don't know that. And again, we don't have any evidence that any of these production crew members received anything. Was this Vince McMahon just his own fan fiction that he was sending Janelle Grant for his own arousal? Like, that is another aspect to this we don't know. But we are at least aware of the fact that Vince McMahon was not concealing this to such a degree that he was withholding it from Brock Lesnar, from Michael Hayes. We know that John Laurinaitis was very, very much tied to this. So while I think Vince McMahon...
Not withholding existence of the relationship.
Of the relationship, yes. And openly having, and documenting this in text form to Janelle Grant. So again, I think that two things can be true here. And the fact that this voicemail, it can certainly prove that they were absolutely trying to withhold this from the board, from the legal department. But that to me does not disqualify the idea that there would be people that had degrees of knowledge of what was going on. I don't necessarily sign off on the idea that people knew to the extent of what's alleged in the complaint. But I think that the idea that people did not know, just the fact that you have your CEO that's in an open relationship with an employee, that alone would be an alarm bell in most businesses. That alone would be a concern before we're even getting to allegations of abuse. Like there are
no policy against it at the time until now. There is an employee consensual relationship policy now.
And that's a greater argument that the defendants could paint here is Vince McMahon was such an omnipotent figure within WWE that if there were allegations of abuse, what are the channels to hold a Vince McMahon accountable within his own company? Like there is no existence of these guardrails that would even suggest that there would be that power beyond SEC violations. But we're just talking about allegations of abuse. Like what are the channels that a Janelle Grant would have had to go through if she was going through abuse and being trafficked?
It is still, just to hammer the point home, it's not illogical to say that, well, if I'm the CEO of a company, I'm the controlling shareholder and all the rest, I've got, my executives just under me, helping me exploit someone, do bad things, et cetera. But then I can also get somebody to sign an NDA that those people don't know about. I think those two things are totally possible at the same time, which is not to say anything about whether or not, whether WWE was in fact guilty of wrongdoing here. So if we want to talk about the arbitration issue in particular here, which is what the amended complaint tries to get at, I think, doing a lot of thinking about whether or not the arbitration clause will be invalidated. We have seen WWE and Vince's attorneys weigh in on why the arbitration clause should be upheld. And from what I understand, I've been trying to track down case law that says one way or the other, because what it looks like you need is you need a strong precedent to weigh in to say, what has been ruled in the past, particularly what is called binding authority. So binding authority would be a judgment from a court such as the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the appeals court above the Connecticut federal court. And it looks like there's some authority in the defendant's favor here, and there's less authority in the plaintiff's favor here. What it looks to me like is that you have to show, if you're Grant, you have to show, let's assume that she was under duress. To my eye, she does not allege explicit threats. She says in one part of the complaint that there were explicit threats. I think there's good reason to believe there were, if you take her allegations at face value, there were implicit threats, right? You've got Vince McMahon, who's a wealthy billionaire who has a lot of power over you, who has allegedly been abusing you. There's good reason to believe that there will be bad consequences for you if you do not sign this NDA. I can see that. Was there a threat of like, if you don't sign this NDA, I'm going to do this to you? Not alleged, not detailed in this complaint at this point. So even if we took for granted that did happen, if you don't sign this NDA, I'm going to do really bad things to you. Let's say that threat was made. It looks like what you still have to show is that there was a specific threat. And let's say she's under duress. You still have to show that there's a specific threat related to the arbitration clause itself. So let's say Grant and McMahon had agreed to this NDA in principle that did not include an arbitration clause. And then they later decided to do a revision that specifically added the arbitration clause. And at that point, at least also, Grant was under duress. That's not what we have here. We have perhaps Janelle Grant being under great duress and emotional distress as related to someone who's allegedly abusing her. But what we might not have is a technical, abstruse legal argument that will allow them to invalidate the arbitration clause. Now, saying that, again, the defendants, WB, McMahon, and Laurinaitis has signed off on it as well. They've presented their motion to compel arbitration a couple of times now. They'll do it again. It probably won't be that different from the submissions that they've already made. And then Grant will get an opportunity to oppose that motion. And we'll see what arguments and what case law they can show to support the notion that what has happened here should cause the arbitration clause to be invalidated. There's also public policy questions. We know they've talked about the Speaking Out Act. The Speaking Out Act pertains to NDAs. It does not pertain, does not mention at all arbitration clauses. There's another law, the EFAA, which is supposed to invalidate, at least in some cases, arbitration clauses in the case of sexual harassment and assault. However, that went into effect, I believe, March 3rd, 2022, and it is not retroactive. So it's literally like 5 or 6 weeks after this NDA is signed. Perhaps if Grant and McMahon had signed this NDA, you know, some 6 weeks later, that the EFAA would weigh in her favor here in terms of invalidating the NDA. It's whatever the opposite of serendipitous is. It's remarkable that it was so close to that time, but it doesn't look like that's something that she can use to her favor here.
The NDA is signed January 28, 2022, and from the original complaint on March 2, 2022, while Ms. Grant was away on a trip to Florida, McMahon called Ms. Grant to advise that it would probably be the last time she would hear from him, and if she needed anything, to contact WWE Corporate Officer Number 1 or WWE Corporate Officer Number 2. Over the course of an approximately half-hour call, McMahon lamented both his inability to focus on the upcoming WrestleMania and how his personal life had blown up over the past few weeks. Toward the end of their conversations, McMahon and Grant agreed to resume contact after WrestleMania. He also, that's quite the conversation where you go from the last time you'll ever hear from me to we will resume contact after WrestleMania. He also instructed Ms. Grant to continue having sexual relations with other men, including WWE Superstar. In the meantime, on or around March 4th, 2022, WWE Superstar messaged Ms. Grant that he was in New York in line with McMahon's orders. Ms. Grant texted WWE Superstar explicit pictures, and on March 27th, WWE Superstar reached out to Ms. Grant again. Ms. Grant interpreted these back-to-back advances as an indication of McMahon's continued control. So all that is to say is that I think what becomes a very blurry aspect of all of this is this NDA is signed on January 28th, 2022. And if I was advising Vince McMahon, the second that this signature was signed, you are never to contact this woman ever again. That is it. You are completely done. Because after that signature is signed and that document is executed on January 28th, like the fact that there was further interaction and that there is outlines here that Grant can assert, to me, would just be like, I just think if I was Vince McMahon's legal counsel, I would be losing my mind at this point to know that this contact was still going on. And
well, not only that, there's the alleged assault that happened after the NDA was signed.
There's the alleged, like any contact, much less anything that can be like in-person interaction between the two. And you combine this with WWE Superstar, who we know to be Brock Lesnar, is contacting her as well. I think that makes it a really tough case to argue on when it comes to the arbitration clause, that up until January 28th might have been more of a clear-cut argument. And after January 28th, I don't know. I think all bets are off.
Well, certainly in terms of the liability clause makes it pretty clear that this covers everything up to this date and before. The arbitration clause, to read part of it, the very beginning of it, it says in the event of any dispute arising under or out of this agreement, its construction, et cetera. I mean, there's room to say that, well, this covers even those events that happened just after. If anything else, part of what the defendants are arguing is that, well, if there's a question of what is arbitrable in this dispute, that's a question for the arbitrator, the arbitration process. And you might see the court say, okay, well, we'll let the arbitrator decide what maybe the post-signing events, the post-signing allegations, maybe those get kicked back to court. Maybe not. I don't know. Then again, I'm not a lawyer on any of this. I've just read a lot about this.
Judge Sarah F. Russell She's going to make this decision on a Friday night at midnight, isn't she?
And I did look into her background. Like, does she have any background that's focused on sexual assault victims or something like that? It doesn't really look like it. Looks like a lot of her scholarly work is around prisoners and recidivism and things like that. There is a really early academic article that she published in 2002 that relates to domestic violence. That's about as close as it gets, though. So she's a brand new federal judge. There isn't a history of her judgments to look back on. But again, her background doesn't obviously point to a particular sympathy that she might have for the plaintiff in this case. There's probably a way in which you could justify keeping this in court, but it would probably open it up for an appeal. We'd be back in the Second Circuit, perhaps.
Not to dive to this has been Brandon's complete world for the last week. What was the latest involving Dr. Carlin Kolker over the past week? Because we had a couple of updates.
So Dr. Kolker, who is the doctor who is associated with Vince McMahon, and Vince McMahon sent Janelle Grant to seek treatment at Dr. Kolker's clinic. And she alleges that she was given all these substances and she wasn't told what she was being given. And she's in state court, not federal court, which is where everything else is. She's in state court trying to get these medical records and other things. So the amended complaint came out and Kolker's attorneys reacted to that by saying, look, she's saying right here in the complaint that she's trying to get evidence to support her federal claims. And you're trying to do this in state court. And they claim, Kolker's attorneys claim, that you can't do this. This is against court rules or the law or something. Right. And so they've asserted that. And they also published they also provided as an exhibit some emails between the two attorney sides where they're discussing, it seems they're discussing a settlement. And we did have a filing earlier in the state case where it appeared that they were discussing a settlement. So maybe this has been blown up. Anyway, we had another filing coming from the plaintiff side, saying that, oh, look, in the course of the settlement discussions, you disclosed that Vince McMahon did pay for these medical agreements. And presumably the Grant side wants records of these payments that were made on behalf of her for her treatment. What I would suggest is that they were close to a settlement. And maybe now they're much further apart. Again, this is not it's probably going too far to call this situation a lawsuit. It is a petition to get records, to get evidence.
Are you going to get the book rights to write about this case one day, Brandon?
I don't know. We'll have to discuss that. I think it's going to be a long story. That's going to, again, like I said, it's going to trickle out over the years, and we have a lot of people whose sides of the story are, you know, we don't even know their identities. So
yeah. Well, there you have it, everybody. We've spent almost a full hour bringing you up to speed. I hope we were able to break that down in a digestible fashion, these 44 pages that came down on Friday, delayed till Monday. But do you know that several McMahons took in the Super Bowl on Sunday? We got one photo, like one angle of Vince McMahon out and about at the Super Bowl. There were no other photos of Vince McMahon beyond this one shot where his eyes are closed looking looking like he's completely caught off guard. And then in a separate shot, we saw images of Shane McMahon, The Undertaker, Tony Khan, and WWE Hall of Famer Donald Trump also at the Super Bowl.
Did you catch Mark Shapiro? Mark Shapiro was not right on TV.
Oh, I missed the Super Bowl entirely and did not know. Did they have breakfast the next morning?
Who knows? I suggested, you know, and to think that Nick Khan would not be here too, with all of these cool sports media people here, I think is quite a leap to not speculate that Nick Khan was present as well. I suggested to someone, you know, I hope they had like a, I hope they got together, you know, earlier in the day or the next day and had like an NWA convention style get together with all the key power players in combat sports and professional wrestling.
Maybe they sat down and read the opinion together. Yeah, he was out. I mean, it's interesting the fact that I just look at Vince McMahon, everything is very coordinated, and maybe it's a little conspiratorial, but I mean, what happened in the summer of 2022? It's like, boom, we get a Vince McMahon just seated in the crowd at a UFC event when they were over in London. But yeah, there he was at the Super Bowl.
I would think like what the Super Bowl has evolved into, this has got to be like this huge networking opportunity for all these big movers and shakers, and he wants to, you know, reportedly he wants to start a new business, so better be there.
Let's go on to, what will be very newsworthy over the next 24 hours or so, and that is Linda McMahon's confirmation hearing that begins on Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern in front of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, which is led by Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders was unable to come on the show this week, but maybe we'll get Bernie on one of these weeks. Already, Democratic Senators Andy Kim of New Jersey and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts have voiced their concerns over McMahon's lack of experience in education. She has served on the Connecticut Board of Education and was on the Board of Trustees at her alma mater, Sacred Heart University. And The Hill writes that, quote, the Senate Democrats said they want to know more from McMahon about her views relating to the student loan system and higher education affordability and the extent to which they overlap with certain extreme stances taken by President Trump, his Project 2025 allies, and former education officials. The senators listed dozens of questions they want McMahon to be prepared to answer on Thursday, with the first set related to Trump's plan to diminish the Department of Education, which, to put this into perspective, Linda McMahon will be tasked with overseeing the $269 billion budget allotted to the Department of Education, which Donald Trump has famously stated he hopes Linda McMahon works herself out of a job.
Yes. We also got a big ethics submission about all of her assets.
Boy,
we don't get particular numbers, but we do get we did get ranges for all the values of the various things that she owns. We don't need to go through it, but suffice to say, she owns a lot of assets. I believe she's supposed to step down from the Trump, basically what is the Truth Social company board upon her confirmation. We do confirm that she still has some TKO shares, which is she's always had WE stock, which converted to TKO shares. It's interesting. I'll bring it up only to this extent that there's part of this filing that is supposed to show all of your spouse's assets, and she lists none, which is you would think if your spouse is Vince McMahon, who has certainly over $1 billion worth of assets, you would list that. But that's that. I bring that up to inquire about whether this was properly filled out or what the explanation is.
And we did have the comment from Laura Brevetti, her attorney, that they were legally separated, but to our knowledge, like there is no legal steps that has been taken to
none. And I did check to see if there's anything in Connecticut family court. There is not.
Yes, I guess estranged would be the proper term.
Do you think Vince will be attending the hearing?
No, you know what? I'm sure he's still reveling in the Philadelphia Eagles victory on Sunday in New Orleans. So I don't think Linda McMahon would be there as a character witness to Linda McMahon overseeing the Department of Education.
Yeah. Stephanie was there last time for her confirmation.
Stephanie, I could very well see being
administration.
There.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It'd be interesting to see.
So yeah, I will warn our viewers: we are not going to be diving into Linda McMahon's plans for the Department of Education, but I think
I want to know about Pell Grants. Do you have anything like Pell Grants? Do you know what a Pell Grant is?
I know what a Pell Grant is, but I don't even think we have access to them here.
It's great.
Yes, she will be overseeing student financial aid programs such as Pell Grants and the enforcement of Title IX. So don't worry, Undertaker. Linda McMahon is going to be very much behind Title IX. And more so to kind of our specific beat will be whether or not the Ring Boy scandal will be referenced at all. It's certainly been mentioned in a lot of these political articles describing Linda McMahon and potential liabilities. But I think the more obvious concerning aspects by especially the Democratic senators will be kind of her education background and what she is planning to be doing with the Department of Education. And that's probably going to take up the lion's share of things. But I don't dismiss the idea that the Ring Boy suit is at least addressed in some form or fashion.
Yeah, I would be surprised if it's not mentioned. I don't expect there to be a big focus on it, sort of like these mainstream articles reflect. They go over this long history of here's who Linda McMahon is, because you don't know, and here's her past and what she's done. She's worked for, there'll be a pun about wrestling and what she's body slammed the business or something, and she served on the Connecticut board. And I understand last time in her confirmation hearing she had Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, who are the senators from Connecticut, both of whom she ran against in her Senate campaigns, were sort of right there with her endorsing her. I don't think we're gonna get that this time, given how even more divisive federal politics have become, especially considering some things that Chris Murphy has said about not voting to confirm anybody. So looking forward to watching it.
I didn't even give thought to the senators that'll be deep in the rotation of questions and when they'll just lean on their awful wrestling jokes. Man, I can only imagine what material will be cooked up.
So we have here, who are the members here? We have Bill Cassidy is the chair. I don't know who that is. Bernie Sanders is the ranking member. In terms of Republicans, we have Rand Paul, Lisa Murkowski. These are all senators. Roger Marshall from Kansas, Josh Hawley, Tommy Tuberville, Tim Scott, Susan Collins. On the Democrat side, we have Chris Murphy, Maggie Hassan, Lisa Blunt, Tammy Baldwin, Tim Kaine, the former vice presidential candidate, Andy Kim, I think you mentioned, John Hickenlooper, and some others.
Yeah, maybe we'll get a, you know, over the last 20 years, the Department of Education has hit rock bottom. We smelled what Barack was cooking, and it's time for the people's educator, Linda McMahon, to come forward and give education back to the states. I'm sure we'll get some stump speeches on
Yeah, unfortunately, she's never been that good of a promo, as we all know.
No, I would be assigning this to one of the senators. I don't know if Linda McMahon will be giving us her finest. But yes, that will be streaming on Thursday morning, and we'll see. Maybe we will chime in if there's anything newsworthy coming out of the hearing. But let's talk about a few more topics before we wrap up. WWE and AEW had a series of cuts or contracts not going to be renewed. On the WWE end, those affected include Duke Hudson, Cedric Alexander, Sonya Deville, Isla Dawn, AOP, Paul Ellering, Electra Lopez, Luke Gallows, Carl Anderson, and yes, Giovanni Vinci. Whereas AEW officially released Miro, Malachi Black's deal is up, and Ricky Starks, who wasted no time debuting on NXT last night, using his name. So maybe
interesting.
Yeah, maybe we'll be getting a Mickey Sparks in NXT. But yeah, a bunch of talent movements, I guess, with WWE. I mean, I think that there is a certain level of talents that they are going to look at and say, what is the investment we have put in these talents, and what do we see as their ceiling? And they are going to be constantly on a youth movement to be creating spots for NXT talent, for Evolve talent to be coming up through this LFG show that's launching this weekend. And these were talents that they clearly saw as expendable. I think it's more noteworthy just the AEW moves, that this is kind of like Malachi Black. It's a contract that is up. However, Tony Khan, we do have him stating the fact that they had Malachi Black, the rights to him through 2027, and that Miro had plenty of time left. Ricky Starks, his contract was reportedly up later this year. So it would be kind of a departure where AEW was letting talent go when they still could have retained them for longer, but essentially cutting these three and allowing them to move on without any restrictions either.
Right, which is interesting. I wonder if that was terms of release or something like that, because, you know, Punk at least did have a non-compete period. I was looking at the trademark for Ricky Starks. This is for wrestling, and it is owned by not AEW. It's owned by something called Dream Palace LLC in Texas. I don't know if that's an LLC that Ricky Starks himself controls or what there. And that's not his legal name, correct?
No.
Ricky Starks? We'll check on that. Our producers will check on that. How many matches, by the way, while we're looking into that, how many matches did Malachi Black have after he
his name is Ricky Starks, so my mistake. It was
that's his legal name.
Yeah, that's what's listed here. I always thought that was not just a ring name, but yeah, that is his actual name.
Okay, so there would be no, anyway. So how many matches did Malachi Black have after he had that match with Adam Cole, in which it prompted him to tell the Dirt Sheets that they're wrong? He had to post that portrait. Orientation.
Yeah, we had him completely drop character, embrace Adam Cole, and Adam Cole like just breaks from everything to applaud this heel villain Malachi.
And he
Black.
Was not leaving AEW.
Yeah, absolutely not. He had, I want to say, two if not three matches after that.
Oh, so he did wrestle after that.
He did wrestle.
All right.
On
so the Dirties are wrong. Okay.
So he did have like two or three more matches after that point, and then we have not seen him since. And I guess we will see if and when he is back.
He did have
back.
Four matches, in fact. Get it right. Well, he had a match outside of AEW. You're right, three in AEW.
Do you look at all in terms of, Miro and Malachi Black, they're both 39 years of age. Do you see that as, you know, any kind of deterrent when WWE is coming to the talent that they are signing? We're talking about, like, this youth movement that they have put such an emphasis on. Do you expect them to be discerning at all when it comes to talent that become available and looking at like the amount of years that we will get out of some of these people? Or do you feel that this is, you know, these are talents that they're going to come in and they're going to get a big response coming in and that they will have kind of a renewed vigor coming from the opposition and back into a WWE system?
I think, I guess like 39 is the, I say this with no bias, 39 is the new 29. Okay. We need to recalibrate how we think about age in this culture. But I do think like the lighter schedule, you know, it's not like you're going to, you know, put everybody on the road for 100, 200 matches as we saw in pretty recent years.
Did you do any of the stats of when you did your whole match totals of WWE and AEW talent? Because none of them are in your top tens of anything.
Indie like wrestlers that. Are all the most traveled, are all the most active wrestlers in the United States. Yeah.
Like I'd imagine the vast majority of AEW and WWE talent aren't even hitting 5 matches a month.
Right. Right. I think Cody was the most, and I think he was close to 100. I'd have to find my thing on that. But yeah.
So it's a totally different landscape. I'm with you as well. Like, I don't think like 40 was always like the number that I think gave Vince like his, like that was sort of his expiration date on talent. And you can just look up and down the rosters and you can see plenty of quality performers going well into their 40s that I don't imagine it being the same deterrent that it was 10 years ago. And as someone that is 40, I will advocate for that. So there you have it. John Orand at Puck reports that the UFC ESPN exclusive negotiating window, which opened in January, will expire April the 15th. And it is expected that this window is going to close and UFC, to their benefit, will go to the open market where it is assumed they are going to have plenty of interest, lots of engagement, lots of appetite for these rights. And
who wants it? Who wants it besides ESPN?
Amazon,
Zaslav, wants
Amazon Prime has flat out stated that they are very intrigued with the UFC package. I think Netflix is going to have a very big interest. And I think the likely expectation is some divvying of the rights here and including ESPN. Like I see ESPN having a very vested interest in retaining at least a portion of its UFC rights, both for its flagship service and for whatever becomes of ESPN Plus once they launch their flagship app.
Yeah, just quickly to interject, Cody Rhodes had the most matches in WWE last year, 83. Orange Cassidy, most for AEW, 67. So Wow. Well under 100 there. I think, you know, it'll be probably a good deal for them. We'll see. And I think the Netflix relationship helps with WWE. But yeah, I'm excited to see what Mark Shapiro can come up with. Mark Shapiro's got a conference coming up at Morgan Stanley, I believe, early March. So we anticipate that highly.
I'm going on a road trip. I think I'm gonna go try and take it in person. Can't wait. I'm counting down already.
You think we could get in? It's probably New York City or something. We could probably get in. No, I think it's on the West Coast actually, because I saw Pacific time.
Your picture is definitely on the wall there. Do not allow.
Do not credential this person.
Yeah, well, it could be either of us. We don't know. Ari Emanuel was on the Pat McAfee show. Not a statement I expected to be reading after the fact, but he was. And casually weighed in on perhaps the repealing of a certain act that was passed back in 2000.
It seems like you do everything, you own everything. Is there anything that you could tell us that you want to get into that maybe you haven't dipped your toe into yet in the business world, sports, whatever it may be?
Well, we're starting to talk about boxing.
Okay.
And so we're going to...
With Dana?
Dana's
start. Dana's been he's been talking about doing boxing for a long time, right?
We're kind of looking at that right now and...
Can you revive boxing? Like, where is boxing right now, I guess, compared to maybe 20 years ago?
Well, I think you got the Ali Act that I think hurt it.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, who knows what's going to happen with the Ali Act. And then Dana's got a plan for boxing. We'll see. You know, there's a lot of work, a lot of wood that's got to be chopped there.
So when those nine
Pat McAfee show, that was not Pat McAfee talking to him.
That was one of his sidekicks that was asking the question there as Pat.
But I do see that he did talk to Pat McAfee. So someone else was just interjecting.
It was one of the sidekicks off screen that they opened the questions to as well. Okay. But it was from this show. I don't think by accident that we'll see what happens to the Ali Act. And for those that are unfamiliar, the Ali Act was passed in 2000. And what this allowed was pretty much if you were to come up with an act to circumvent exactly what the UFC has built, it's what this is. It was taking a system in boxing and eliminating the ability for one promoter to have such a control over all the top fighters, to sign them to extended contracts where I can sign you for 7 fights and have you constrained to this contract. It allows fighters to have a lot more flexibility. It forces promoters to obey the various sanctioning bodies. It allows to have that third party that is overseeing all of the different championship belts, rather than having a promotion that can take such a control of it. It's exactly why you would think a TKO would look at this as like, this is the antithesis of MMA, where we have thrived by a system that is not regulated by the Muhammad Ali Act and allows us to be able to have such a concentration of the marketplace and not allow any promoter to get within any kind of spitting distance of our dominance of the marketplace. The process of repealing this, I wouldn't even begin to understand where you are starting from, but all bets are off in this administration of what could be pulled off. So I don't think there should be anything that boxing promoters are just taking as some empty threat. When
do you have Republicans in both chambers of Congress, so maybe it's possible.
It very well could be possible. And this also comes when we saw that, like, Elon Musk, who is trying to has put together a consortium to pretty much bid for OpenAI, and who's one of the people part of this consortium? It's Ari Emanuel as well. So don't never underestimate the political capital that an Ari Emanuel holds.
Apparently, their bid is like way under what it's already been valued at. So
it was a mere $97 billion. I mean, come on, I've got that.
But it's worth like well over $100 billion or something like that. So it seems to be a strategic bid to mess with Sam Altman or something.
Yes, well, let's Elon Musk
we
is.
We should just do a non-wrestling show. Come on,
I think so. I think we would be so popular if we just talked about like Elon Musk every week, and we could just broadcast exclusively to Twitter. We would get such wonderful dialogue from people. I'd love it. Last thing, any big takeaways from Netflix viewership this past week? We had WWE Raw ranking 3rd globally and ranking in the top 10 among 10 countries. 10 countries. How are you enjoying these viewership charts, Brandon? How's the transition been from Nielsen to ta-dum?
Ta-dum. It's giving me some issues. So I understand. I understand Dave wrote something about this recently, and I've been discussing with him the math issues surrounding the Netflix viewership. So I was looking at this yesterday. And let's get really boring here and try to explain this. So
Raw was 7th globally, and I think they were 3rd in the US, but go ahead.
Yeah. So they publish global views, which is kind of like the Nielsen measurement. I say that because it's average minute audience, and they're publishing the hours viewed too, which is presumably just a multiplication formula of duration times, or the global views is hours watched divided by duration, divided by the number of hours it was to some fraction. And so they publish these three data points: the weekly hours viewed, the runtime, and the weekly views. However, if you do the math for yourself, you get a different number throughout these 5 weeks so far that they've reported. Especially the first week, you get a very different number. You get a number that is 19% lower. For the 2 weeks after that, you get a number that is 9% lower. For the week after that, you get a number that is actually 14% higher. For this most recent week that they just reported, which is the February 3rd episode, so not this past Monday, but 2 Mondays ago, well, that's 3% off, which is, I understand these numbers are rounded to the nearest 100,000. I hope everyone's hanging in there. So you'd expect some discrepancy to some extent because of this rounding, but you would not expect a difference of 19% or 14%. So I have asked Netflix PR. They have not gotten back to me yet, but that was just a few hours ago. It is questionable, I will say. And I think might explain this, whatever methodology they're using, is that this programming is live. So they might be just measuring the live viewership differently than they're measuring the delayed viewership. In any case, it's confusing and it raises questions. Yeah.
And thus, the streaming era, as we are officially diving headfirst on it, and these are really the infancy ages where I really hope that we get some level of advancement when it comes to this, because we're so reliant really on Netflix disclosing and figuring out, you know, some of
this. We should start our own independent nonprofit that is just trying to measure these things, trying to measure all live streaming telecasts.
Well, if you can come up with the system that monitors that, you will be a billionaire overnight. All right. It will be,
Yeah, well, why don't the SAG-AFTRA or something, you know, sort of organize some sort of measurement system if Nielsen can do with whatever 25,000 samples or whatever they have.
Well, maybe that is a task. Maybe SAG can save the professional wrestling data viewership industry, and maybe they can also help unionize professional wrestlers as well.
Yeah, good luck with that.
So those are their tasks for 2025. Last thing is that this coming Saturday, AEW is in Brisbane, Australia for the much maligned Grand Slam Australia card that has produced a lot of unrest, in particular on Reddit, of people that bought tickets for this. And I guess this has been one of the most confusing events that this company has ever promoted. But the end result is that this will be airing late Saturday night after the NBA All-Star festivities. So they're going to get an enormous lead in, and it will be simulcast on both TBS and it's on TNT, correct? TNT and TNT. Max. So, it will not be airing live on Max. So this will be probably airing roughly 16 hours or so after it takes place in Brisbane. So that is what is going down. It's a pretty big card that they have put together. Like, I would say this is not like a throwaway, you know, episode of Collision. But that said, I think like there's a lot of people that had booked trips across Australia or from outside of Australia to go attend this event, which originally was going to take place at, Suncorp Stadium, Sun Life Stadium, something of that sort.
Suncorp, I believe, yeah.
That was going to hold around 50,000 people. It was quietly downscaled, and this is the event that we have on Saturday. And there have been complaints about some people like not being able to get refunds on their tickets as well. That has been mentioned as well among people. I don't think that this is overall been a great inroads into Australia for AEW. We will see what the discussion is coming out of this show, but certainly going into it, there's been a lot of complaints about this.
Yeah. And I've seen a little bit of speculation about whether they have a site fee for this. I would be very surprised if they have a site fee. Given the lack of track record, I understand WWE did get apparently got a site fee. Oh, well, we know they got $16 million for some combination of events, according to Mark Shapiro, between UFC and WWE. $16 million for the Elimination Chamber in Perth. That event was part of the $16 million. I would be kind of surprised if AEW has ever gotten something other than a subsidy for running an event, but I could be wrong.
I mean, if there's a site fee, you would think that we'll get at least a hint of it on Saturday. Like, you would think there would have to be some sort of promotional aspect to it. Like, just watching UFC 312 on Saturday, which was in Sydney, Australia. Dude, this thing was like a tourism ad. Like, they had everything about Visit Sydney. They had fighters out talking about Dricus du Plessis learning how to surf. And, man, this is a great place to visit with the Visit Sydney logo. Like, they splashed this all over the place.
And I would think, too, if you're Brisbane or whatever the municipality is that supposedly would have paid a site fee, probably pretty disappointed after you thought you were going to have X number of people coming to a stadium event, you know, and now you've got X minus something of people coming to an arena event.
All right, that's going to bring an end to the show. We hope you're all up to date.
I do want to thank Kurt Angle for giving
thank you, Kurt,
and saying we have the best source on the case on the Vince case, bar none. Thank you.
Well, we always appreciate the main eye that Brandon always brings, that being integrity, Kurt. So thank you very much. We will be back next week, same time and place, Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. I am back tonight with Wei Ting. We will be live immediately after Dynamite over at postwrestlingcafe.com, where you can watch and listen live. We will be going through Dynamite as well as all the New Japan happenings over the past couple of days. I know Brandon really wants to talk about Hirooki Goto today, but I told him, you know what, we just don't have time to fit in anymore.
I saw discussion. It left after all those years.
Finally happened. A big one.
Finally won the big one.
for Goto. So that's happening tonight after Dynamite. And of course, you can go subscribe to WrestleNomics over at patreon.com/WrestleNomics or on Substack, where you get the award-winning WrestleNomics report each and every week. And it's always great to get Brandon's breakdown of the industry, what is happening, and him making sense of all the pro wrestling world's problems.
Yeah, you get the TV ratings reports as well. Quarter hour reports should be coming out this week. And we do, WrestleNomics is a democracy. We held a poll, and for some minor legal updates, I'll probably be including that going forward, because I believe we had, last I checked, a super majority advocating for that.
You know what needs to happen sooner or later? We need to have another a la Randy Orton trademark case over a tattoo in a video game, because you can get years of coverage out of one of those cases.
Have you seen the transcripts for his testimony in the trial?
No, I have not, but I would love to see those.
Apparently, I don't know if I can pull it up in enough time here, but apparently the judge expressed some displeasure with how Mr. Orton was conducting himself in the court. His entrance into the courtroom was inappropriate, and apparently he was making faces in the courtroom.
Did he stand on the desk and put his arms up in the air as he walked in?
That's all I can think of. Like, he must have pushed the doors open in the courtroom and done his Randy Orton.
Were the voices in his head under oath?
You never know.
Do we know what he was thinking? Yeah. Well, I would love to read this. It's whenever you get any of these people under the best was that congressional hearing back in 2007 after the Benoit murder suicide. From Vince McMahon, Dixie Carter, who famously compared her wrestling audience. Have you ever seen the 40-year-old virgin? That's our audience. I mean, just some gems that came out of that. That's something we should do a dramatic reading of one of these days, Brandon.
So the judge says, I believe this is
look
the judge
at this. Speaking.
We have another issue. I didn't address it at the time because I didn't want to draw more attention to it, and I was hoping it wasn't a preview of things to come from Mr. Orton. His entrance into the courtroom was inappropriate. But beyond that, during our sidebar, according to my staff, Mr. Orton continued to make faces and gestures to the jury. Like, what's going on? And Mr. Orton actually made the statement, quote, what the fuck is going on, end quote. Mr. Orton continues to look at the court security officer, making gestures, raising in front of the jury. Need I say more? I assume like maybe something was happening right at that moment. One of the attorneys says, I'll instruct him, Your Honor. He's never been in a courtroom before. And then the judge goes on to say, he's never been in a courtroom before, but I'm confident that you explained to him before he came to court this morning. And I understand some people have difficulty. So the judge was not happy with, we don't see the visuals of what's happening here, but the judge not happy with Randy Orton, his conduct in the courtroom.
Vintage Randy Orton. Yes. On that note, everyone, we will say farewell. I am so happy that I made the most non sequitur bringing up Randy Orton and Brandon having that right on file to bring up for all of you. This is what you get if you stick right to the end of the show. Okay, we're gonna go through a lot of legal documents and stuff, but once you get to the end, that's when the gems fall out of the sky. Thanks to everyone for joining us. We'll be back next Wednesday. This month at postwrestlingcafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. Postwrestlingcafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always on the verge of death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone. Up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.